American Islamic Relations, or CARE, Hossam Ailouche, said that Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence. Hossam Ailouche added, Muslims continue to be the target of hate, bullying and discrimination as a result of the stereotypes that were perpetuated by Islamophobes and the media in the years following the 9/11 attacks. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Muslims skyrocketed immediately after the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and are still on an upward trend. Hossam Ailouche said, "The unfortunate reality is there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry and war." Ailouche further said that the statistics were not surprising considering the current volatile political climate in the United States, perpetuated by former President Donald Trump during his term in office, adding, "Trump's presidency normalized being an anti-Muslim bigot. He made it socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Muslim." Upon taking office in January of 2017, Donald Trump signed an executive order that banned travel to the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Citing the Muslim ban, Ailouche said, "Although the current administration overturned that ban, we're still dealing with the ramifications of it to this day, with many families still being separated." Hossam Ailouche noted that the U.S. has a long history of dehumanizing and marginalizing ethnic and religious groups, including Native Americans, African Americans, and Asian Americans. The Hill, an American newspaper based in Washington, D.C., explains more about this story. Since the 11th of September 2001 attacks, Muslims living in the United States have experienced political and cultural firsts, along with an exponential rise in hate crimes, bullying, harassment, and racial profiling. In the years following the 9/11 attacks, anti-Muslim sentiments grew in the United States. Data from Brown University revealed from 2000 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims spiked 500%. Beyond former President Barack Obama's presidency, critics contend that former President Donald Trump's policies exhibited animosity towards the community, such as his Muslim travel ban, which included predominantly Muslim countries. In 2020, the Justice Department found there were 110 anti-Muslim incidents in the United States. The Department of Justice also found that religion was the second most common reason for single bias incidents in the United States. A Pew Research survey found U.S. Republicans increasingly associated Muslims with Islam and violence, with 72% of Republicans in 2021 believing Islam was more likely than other religions to encourage violence. Among Democrats, 32% felt the same. Abdullah Hamoud, the first Muslim American mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, told Changing America that there was a sense of urgency among members of the Muslim American community to step up and push back against Islamophobia in a post-9/11 America. Before becoming mayor of Dearborn, Hamoud ran for a seat in Michigan's state legislature. He shared that doors were slammed in his face when he introduced himself. Representatives Rashiba Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, and Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, became the first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. The Progressive Squad members are two of the most prominent Muslim voices in American politics, elected in the Blue Wave 2018 midterm elections during the Trump administration. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have previously shared that they've received violent threats during their time in U.S. Congress. The Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. Commemorations for the 9/11/2001 events remain an important part of US history, but for Muslim Americans, post-9/11 ramifications of Islamophobia have bled deep into the fabric of American society more than two decades later. As a result, 21 years after the suspicious attacks, Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence and are working to amplify narratives about Muslims that are authentic and accurate to counter the spread of misinformation. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes immediately against Muslims skyrocketed after the 9/11 attacks, rising 1.61% from 2000 to 2001, marking some of the highest hate numbers of Islamophobic hate crimes ever seen in America. Referring to an August 2022 study, Zahra Jamal, Associate Director of Rice University's Bonnyuk Institute for Religious Tolerance in Houston, Texas, said 62% of Muslims report feeling religion-based hostility from others, and 65% have felt disrespected. That's almost three times the percentage among Christians. She said Muslims in the United States also reported that they have been threatened with physical violence, chased or followed, or had their home vandalized due to their religion. They also have higher rates of experiencing physical assault or property damage due to their religion. According to Zahra Jamal, just over 80% of Muslims reported that others assumed things about them due to their religion, while 21% of Muslim adults reported police harassment. She said the numbers related to discrimination against Muslims are alarming and show just how much Islamophobia has increased in the United States over the past several years. Zahra Jamal added, "For Muslims, scores on the Islamophobia Index have increased from 18 in 2018 to 26 in 2022.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, has visited the Russian capital Moscow to hold political talks. During his trip, he had meetings with several high-level Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement has stated that Haniyeh was also accompanied by a high-ranking Hamas delegation during his Russia visit, including Deputy Hamas Chief Saleh Arouri and members of the Hamas Political Bureau. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement also visited Russia in May 2022, where it appealed to Moscow for support in confronting Israel. So far, Russia has been vocal about its support for Palestine, and this was indicated in Haniyeh's Moscow visit 2 years ago, where he praised Moscow for defending the rights of Palestinians, and also dismissed a pro-Israel proposal, namely former US President Donald Trump's self-proclaimed so-called deal of the century. But there has been something different about the talks held between Hamas and Russia this year. The two sides had their meetings amid simmering tensions between Moscow and Tel Aviv. Relations between Russia and Israel have taken a turn for the worse since the beginning of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. Israel blatantly expressed its opposition to the Russian move, stating that it considers the military action a violation of international law. Moscow, on the other hand, hit back, saying Israel is trying to divert attention from the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Russia, Putin just finally got it enough. with Israel's playing around. Russia has a big big commitment because there's a lot of Russian Jews in Israel. But at some point, they're not getting their pensions now because of the Western sanctions, and Israel's bombing in Syria constantly, and now you've got it invading Gaza. That it's just, it's beyond the pale. And then Israel turns around and votes against Russia in the UN Human Rights Council, which is just another slap in the face. The horrors that Israel perpetuates all the time and gets away with there. So yes, this is a moment where Russia is finally going back to its roots, which were after 48, when it played with Israel. It got burnt and it went for a moral position to support the Palestinians. And that's where Russia is returning to now. So it's an exciting moment.
Israel's hawkish stance against Russia may backfire on the regime. For starters, Russia is a UN veto-wielding member, and it can go against Israel. Furthermore, Russia's pro-Hamas stance can spread to other resistance groups, and this could translate into military support, something Israel would vehemently oppose. While Tel Aviv has been able to get away with violating Palestinian rights, now it has to worry about Hamas military action against it. And this may end up being very costly for it. Israel's remarks around the Ukraine conflict, where it slammed Russia, saying its actions are a violation of international law, have sparked anger in Moscow. And this while Russia says Israeli mercenaries are fighting side by side with the Ukrainians against the Russians only worsens the already simmering tensions. Relations between Moscow and Tel Aviv have also soured following Israel's continued airstrikes in Syria, despite criticism from Moscow. But could all this mean that Israel has given up on ties with Moscow and may even be looking for confrontation with Russia?
Israel is already confronting Russia. It was the reason behind a Russian plane being shot down. With Israel playing its tricks in the air. And this is a continual onslaught against Syria, against the Syrian government that Russia is supporting, and Russia is trying to stabilize Syria, get rid of ISIS. Israel is playing games there. It's trying to undermine Russia and Assad. And it's actually supporting ISIS at some points, along with the U.S., with its dirty tricks. So I really think that Russia, it's very much like the situation in Ukraine. Russia, Putin has been very low-key and very restrained in Ukraine. It could have blasted right from the start and killed tens of thousands and forced to surrender, but it didn't, because Ukrainians are almost Russians, and Putin didn't want that. But because of what the U.S. is doing and because of Zelensky, it's turned into a bloodbath. Well, that's exactly the same kind of situation that you see in Syria. And Israel is promoting the bloodbath. So let's hope that Russia finally against Israel, which it should have done a long time ago.
Degrading ties between Moscow and Tel Aviv have, however, sparked fresh hope for the Palestinians to become a powerful member of the international community that can upgrade its resistance against the years-long Israeli oppression, aggression, and blockades. This would also fly in the face of the U.S. side, which has staunchly supported Israel. The events of September 11, 2001 shook the world. People watched across the globe as newsreels showed a Boeing 767 crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center just before 9 a.m. in what initially appeared to be a terrible accident. When a second plane crashed into the South Tower 18 minutes later, it became clear that this was an attack. A third plane also crashed into the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and a fourth plane crashed into rural Pennsylvania. 3,000 people were immediately killed in these attacks. Al-Qaeda, which was a terrorist network led by bin Laden, was quickly identified as being responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the Taliban housed Al-Qaeda during those times. Within 10 days of the attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush initiated America's so-called War on Terror and began its invasion of Afghanistan. In 2001, both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of the Afghan capital in a matter of months, so the U.S. strategy soon shifted from combat to what it said was stabilizing and rebuilding the country. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was dead, but U.S. troops stayed in the country, mostly supporting the government in Kabul through air power and training Afghan troops. While the U.S. presence seemed fruitful at first, across the rural countryside, support for the Taliban gained ground. This was mainly because of the U.S.'s massive campaign of airstrikes and bombings, much of which have had high civilian death tolls. So in essence, the Taliban had been defeated, yet the American presence brought them back from the dead. In 2021, despite America's longest war in history, the world witnessed Taliban forces sweeping through districts and gaining control of the country, and the U.S. suddenly removing its troops only facilitated the process. All this, from the U.S.'s inability to stabilize the country to its disastrous pullout, has led to questions regarding Washington's aims in Afghanistan and how it truly failed there.
Well, basically, we went into Afghanistan allegedly in response to 9/11 to find bin Laden and to kill him or to bring him to justice. We never did. And when ultimately bin Laden was found, he was not in Afghanistan. When the initial troops had been established there, there was a shift then to what might be called nation building. That is, we felt that Afghanistan should not be a home for terrorism, should not be a safe haven. Therefore, we will transform it in our own image. And this was the first sign of trouble. And we fought a war that went on for 20 years that we ultimately lost. And we withdrew with our tail between our legs as a result of a mistaken policy and a mistaken philosophy to begin with, that we could have changed other countries without knowing anything about their culture, their language, or their way of life. And that was the ultimate mistake. It led to devastation in Afghanistan.
The war on terror began more than 20 years ago by the Bush administration, with the main goal of rooting out terrorism. But the world has witnessed that it has been a complete and utter disaster, and now it is widely believed that it has led to an increase in the number of global terrorist organizations. Reports show that since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, terrorist organizations have almost doubled. The so-called War on Terror also gave birth to the U.S. Authorities for Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, a law that has so far drained billions of dollars out of the American people's pockets and reshaped U.S.'s foreign policy. The U.S. also used the AUMF to invade Iraq, but after years of conflict, it seems that this was all essentially a way to provide additional unilateral power to the executive branch, one which allows the U.S. to wage war and engage in conflict across the globe. While the U.S. claimed that it aimed to make the world a safer place, it has in fact done the opposite and made the world much less safe. The U.S. war on terror goes beyond the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. Terrorism has actually endured in the broader West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the U.S. and its continuing warmongering aspirations. The U.S. is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the U.S. says is a war on terror.
The war on so-called war on terror was meant to keep the world save for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq, there was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy, and this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation.
Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation. In the absence of outlets for oppressed Palestinians to resist and tell their narratives, social media are one of the few tools at their disposal to counter Israeli disinformation campaigns. However, social media platforms, which were once heralded as means of free speech and liberation, have been complicit in the suppression and silencing of pro-Palestinian voices, a practice dubbed digital apartheid by some. Israel's attempts to erase the humanity of the Palestinians or whitewash its crimes against them continue unabated. Facebook's massive media monopoly, rebranded as Meta to save face from years of controversies surrounding it, is one of Israel's favorite ways to censor and control political debate in Palestine. Now, in a fresh crackdown on Palestinian social media content, several platforms owned by Meta have targeted accounts of dozens of pro-Palestinian individuals, including activists, writers, and journalists. Facebook and WhatsApp have closed many accounts for covering Israel's August bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip and reporting on Palestinian civilian deaths. The targeted individuals have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content. They say the social networking platforms have cited breaching their publishing standards for the crackdown.
I posted a number of photos detailing the civilians killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip on August 17. They then accused me of breaching their publishing standards. But the real reason is clear. It's about cleansing the platforms of Palestinian content.
My first warning came when I published a photo of Adam Nablusi, who was killed by occupying forces. I was suspended from posting or commenting for 30 days while my posts were reviewed. I believe that the closure of my WhatsApp account is about stopping me publishing my journalistic work.
Sada Social, an initiative that records and monitors the suspension of Palestinian content and accounts on social media platforms, announced that Meta had mainly targeted activists based in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Nida Basumi, the media coordinator at Sada Social, says there has been an agreement in place between the Israeli regime and major social media networks since 2016 over controlling Palestinian content. She also pointed to double standards imposed by Meta when it comes to censoring content.
It launched an intensive campaign against Palestinian journalists by restricting social media posts reporting breaking news from Palestine. But it did not restrict the Israeli forces' video showing them raiding Nablus and killing Palestinians.
Israel and its allies are not only pressuring big tech to silence pro-Palestinian voices from outside. Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent body tasked with deliberating on the platform's content decisions, includes a former official at an Israeli ministry cyber unit, Emmy Palmer. She personally lobbied for the removal of thousands of pieces of Palestinian content from Facebook.
You know, it happens to all journalists all over the world, to all people who are pro-Palestinian all over the world. We have to fight with that. It's not only the Palestinian social media. It's all social media and all the people that ignore the narrative and are trying to do their jobs right. It's all the people that try to communicate a truth that the narrative doesn't like, the main narrative.
Since the very beginning, social media companies have collaborated with centers of power in the U.S. They even collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on surveillance and big data analysis. So it's not just a few influential pro-Israeli voices co-opting social media companies into silencing pro-Palestinian voices. The industry itself is rotten to its core.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It is estimated that the Queen Elizabeth funeral will cost about £6 billion. This is while Britain is now in the middle of a cost of living crisis. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. According to Press TV, Britain's economy grew by less than expected in July, raising the risk that is already in a recession. With a sharp climb in energy tariffs hurting demand for electricity and a leap in the cost of materials hitting the construction sector. With inflation at a 40-year high of more 10%, gross domestic product expanded by 0.2% from June. Official data showed recently weaker than a median forecast of 0.4%. In the 3 months to July, GDP was flat compared with the previous three-month period. Some economists said recently, the recent data suggested the economy might be on course to shrink in the July-September period, having contracted by 0.1% in the April-June quarter. This would mean that the UK enters a technical recession for the first time since lockdown restrictions ended, Jake Finney, an economist at PwC, said. Paul Dales at Capital Economics said, a disproportionately small rebound in real GDP in July suggests that the economy has little momentum and is probably already in recession. Press TV said in August, the Bank of England forecast a recession for the world's fifth biggest economy lasting from the end of 2022 until early 2024, due in large part to the hit to living standards from energy prices, pushed up by the war in the Eastern Europe. But last week, Liz Truss announced a cap on domestic energy tariffs, which, along with an expected round of tax cuts, reduce the risk of such a protracted hit to the economy, albeit at a cost of £100 billion, or more to Britain's already stretched public finances. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said anecdotal evidence suggested that the surge in power prices was changing consumer behavior and demand for energy had fallen. Electricity prices leapt by 54% in the 12 months to July, part of the surge in power cost that led to new prime minister. Gross domestic production had fallen by 0.6% in June, which included 2 days of public bank holidays to celebrate the late Queen Elizabeth's 7 years on the British throne. An ONS spokesperson said the impact of the holidays was not a big factor in July. Samuel Toombs at Pantheon Macroeconomics said a new public holiday scheduled for September 19th, the day of the Queen's funeral, would reduce economic output by 0.2 percentage points this month, but a recession would probably be narrowly avoided. Despite the slowing economy, the BOE is expected to raise interest rates again on September 22nd as it seeks to combat an inflation rate above 10%. A heat wave in July, which brought record-breaking temperatures, might have been another factor behind the fall in power demand, although there were signs that it boosted ice cream manufacturers and visits to amusement parks and golf clubs, the ONS said. Separate trade figures also showed the impact of soaring prices, with the value of imports of fuel hitting an all-time high of £11 billion in July and representing a record 21% of all goods imports. Guardian also reported the figures come amid growing concern over the strength of Britain's economy as soaring living costs weigh on households' spending power. The Bank of England has warned high inflation fueled by rising energy bills will probably plunge the economy into a lengthy recession this winter. It comes as businesses curtail events during the national mourning period after the death of Queen Elizabeth last week, while the bank has pursued back a decision on raising interest rates by a week to September 22nd in a mark of respect. Faced with soaring inflation, the central bank is expected to raise borrowing costs by at least 0.5 percentage points from the current rate of 1.75%, despite the mounting risks to growth. Guardian added, economists said the extra public holiday for the Queen's funeral next week would have potential to weigh on growth in September, as the hospitality and tourism sector would unlikely benefit while many businesses would be shut. In the hottest month since 1884, with a temperature of 40 degrees Celsius exceeded in the UK for the first time, the ONS said the production sector also recorded a sharp fall in activity due to reduced gas and electricity power generation. With inflation at the highest level since 1980s, driven by soaring costs for energy, high prices hit the construction sector, where there was an 0.8% fall in activity in July after a 1.4% decline a month earlier. Prices for concrete, plaster, brick, sand, gravel, and asphalt were a problem for the industry in particular, holding back the sector despite continued demand for building work and the economic recovery from the COVID pandemic.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyah on August 30th, 2022. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. The report we listened to from Mr. Raisi, the Honorable President, and also the rest of the gentlemen whom we have listened to, have been very beneficial. Let us remember our dear martyrs, Martyr Rajai and Martyr Bahonar. These two men were truly and honestly two equal leaders of the Islamic Revolution. Both of them, well, I worked alongside both of them for many years, especially Mr. Bahonar. I knew them and saw them up close in person. The Almighty Allah rewarded them with martyrdom. It would have been truly a pity if these people had died in deaths other than martyrdom. Let us remember them.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Government Week has two functions, one of which is often neglected. I shall talk about both of these functions. The first function of Government Week is the issue of remembering, like remembering Martyr Rajai and Martyr Bahonar, and remembering the event that took place during the revolution. Remembering stands opposite to neglect. It stands opposite to forgetfulness, which in itself is a great disease. Negligence and forgetfulness are great diseases. You can only warn people who follow the remember. You can only warn someone who follows the reminder, the Quran in verse 11, chapter 36. Reminder is the word of dhikr. We have sent down to you a book in which there is an admonition for you. A chapter in the Quran, chapter 21, verse 10. One of the most important issues that religion pursues is the creating awareness in people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The New York judge overseeing a tax fraud case against the Trump Organization on Monday, 12th of September, rejected any effort to delay next month's trial, acknowledging concerns that the former president, Donald Trump's company, might be trying to stall the criminal case. The judge cautioned against delaying tactics and said the trial will begin on 24th of October. Please stay with us for more details. ABC News has covered the story and has this to say. It's starting to look like the Trump Organization is trying to stall its upcoming criminal trial in New York until after the midterm elections, a judge said on Monday, 12th of September, during a pre-trial hearing. Former President Donald Trump's family real estate firm is scheduled to start trial on 24th of October for fraud and tax evasion. We are not delaying the start of the trial, Judge Juan Merchan said on Monday, 12th of September. A prosecutor, Joshua Steinglass, had accused attorneys for the Trump Organization of gamesmanship by failing to disclose the names of expert witnesses the defense will call to testify, as required under the rules of discovery. The name of the game has been delay, Joshua Steinglass said. Defense attorney Susan Neschels said she was sandbagged by the accusation and explained that the defense's approach to the case had changed after last month's guilty plea by longtime Trump Organization chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg. Weisselberg pleaded guilty last month to all 15 counts in an indictment that accused him of failing to pay taxes on nearly $2 million in fringe benefits the Trump Organization allegedly paid him, off the books. As part of his plea deal, he agreed to testify against the Trump Organization in next month's trial. We are now restructuring our defense, Susan Neschels said. This is all a result of Mr. Weisselberg's pleading guilty. The case against the Trump Organization is dramatically strengthened by the guilty plea, Steinglass claimed. The judge gave the defense until next Monday to provide the names of the experts they would call to testify, what they would testify to, and how that testimony is relevant to the case. The judge also told the defense not to make arguments to the jury that imply the company was charged by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office merely because it is owned by the former president. No selective prosecution, Judge Merchant said, adding he would also preclude arguments at trial that suggest this is a novel prosecution. Those are not defences, Judge Merchant said. I will have very little patience at trial. The trial is expected to last about a month. Alan Weisselberg's plea agreement contains no requirements for a long-time chief financial officer to cooperate in the criminal fraud case against Donald Trump himself, which is separate from the case against the Trump Organization. The Reuters news agency has also reported on the same story, but giving us more details. The New York judge overseeing a tax fraud case against the Trump Organization on Monday rejected any effort to delay the trial, acknowledging concerns that former President Donald Trump's company might be trying to stall the criminal case. At a pretrial hearing in a New York State court in Manhattan, Justice Juan Merchan warned against delaying tactics, even as a Trump Organization lawyer said the decision by longtime chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg to plead guilty changed how the defense will present its case. One of the accusations is the defense is trying to stall, Judge Juan Merchan said. It's starting to feel that way a little bit. I'm repeating, we are not delaying this trial. It's starting on 24th of October and we're going forward. Prosecutors charged Trump's company and Alan Weisselberg in July 2021 with scheming to defraud, tax fraud, and falsifying business records for awarding off-the-book perks to senior executives. The Trump Organization, which manages golf clubs, hotels, and other real estate around the world, has pleaded not guilty and faces possible fines and other penalties if convicted. Alan Weisselberg initially pleaded not guilty, but changed his plea on 18th of August and agreed to testify, though he is not cooperating with prosecutors' larger probe into Donald Trump himself. His plea agreement calls for a 5-month jail sentence. Judge Juan Merchan also said he will not let the Trump Organization argue to jurors that it was a victim of selective prosecution by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, now led by Democrat Alvin Bragg. Susan Neschels, a lawyer for the company, said Alan Weisselberg felt he was being targeted because of his ties to the Republican former president. "I believe that he will say that he thinks he was targeted because of his association with Donald Trump and pleaded guilty in part from concerns that the targeting would continue and he would be unfairly punished," Neschels said. Susan Neschels also said Alan Weisselberg told prosecutors that no one other than himself and Trump Organization controller Jeffrey McConney, who was immune from prosecution, knew about the tax wrongdoing. "He has no knowledge of former President Trump knowing anything about it or any of the other Trumps," Neschels said. Assistant District Attorney Joshua Steinglass disputed her characterization of Weisselberg's discussion with prosecutors. Nicholas Gravanti, a lawyer for Alan Weisselberg, declined to comment. Donald Trump has not been charged or accused of wrongdoing in this case. Outside of the courtroom, Susan Neschels took issue with any suggestion of a stall. The trial is expected to last about 4 weeks. "I'm not stalling," Susan Neschels said. "I'm ready for trial."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will, to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamed is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967.
So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance, but for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis. I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Saeed Pereza, London.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food. As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban deputy economy minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington's sanctions on the war-ravaged